Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I am in Sydney as we go to air today, enjoying my time and learning and networking at the PFOW Sydney 20 event. And I don't get to Sydney as often as I like to anymore. I lived here for 12 years and it was glorious. And I have to say that although I was ready to move on by the time my family and I packed up and moved back to Victoria a little over 7 years ago now, I love getting the chance to come back to visit. I always make sure that I spend some time by the harbour watching the sunlight twinkle on the water, and I get my urban fix in the hustle of the CBD, and of course I get the chance to catch up with beloved friends and former colleagues, which is an absolute treat. So while I'm enjoying all of that, I'm going to give you an update on some events that are coming up here at PPHQ. In a couple of weeks, I have this season's solo episode hitting the airwaves. So this is something I've done for the last couple of seasons, is add in a solo episode where I talk about a particular topic or area of maybe expertise, or certainly something that I've learned a lot about as a psychologist. And this episode, this season, is on personality. So what is it? Where does it come from? What do we know about all of those personality tests that you can do, like Myers-Briggs and DISC? Are they any good? How much control do we have over our personality? Can we change it? And I'm covering this topic at the request of a listener who sent me an email asking whether I could talk about personality. And she's interested particularly in the role that our personality has on our motivation and getting things done. So that episode is coming up. And I'll talk about all of those topics, but I'm conscious that in the podcast format, I get to talk to you, but you don't get to ask questions. So if personality is a topic that particularly interests or intrigues you, I'm going to run a webinar in a few weeks' time that gives you the chance to ask your burning questions. So I did run a webinar in January on personal projects and planning and goals, and it was excellent being able to answer questions and work through some of our community's individual challenges and needs. So we do that in the chat, so you don't have to talk or be on camera, so don't worry about that. You just enter your question in the chat box on the webinar and I will be on camera answering your questions or talking you through whatever it is that you are wondering about. So I'm really excited to be doing all of that again. This webinar will be held on Monday the 16th of March at 10 a.m. Australian Daylight Savings Time. So it will be recorded. So if you can't make the live session, I'll send you a link to the recording if you've registered. So make sure you do register, even if you know you're not going to be able to attend, because then I'll know that you want the recording. And of course, if you do attend the live session, I'll also send you a copy of the recording as well in case you'd like to watch it again. And all of the details, including the link to register, are in the show notes for today's episode. So you can head over there and register, and then I'll be able to see you. Well, no, I won't be able to see you. You'll be able to see me, but I'll be able to hear directly from you on the 16th of March. I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm really hoping that you can join me. Now, today's conversation. Today's conversation is a joy and maybe a little bit self-indulgent on my part. Like me, my guest has a passion for sharing the science of human behaviour to a bigger audience. So I know I've mentioned this on the show before, but one of the drivers of this podcast for me is being able to share expertise and knowledge and news and research in psychology and her sister fields with you so that you can take all of that good stuff and put it to work in your life. And I've always had an interest in this. I've dabbled in freelance writing, and then I started my blog and the social media channels, and ultimately, or as things presently stand, this podcast. So it's really exciting to be able to talk to someone with a similar goal, although his delivery, as you'll hear and see if you check out his YouTube channels and very cool visual content, is kind of different to mine. But that's good because we need everyone. And I get to ask him about why, his why. So what's his purpose in doing this work? And I get to pick his brain a little on what he has learned and how. So let's listen into that, shall we? My guest today is the man behind The Daily BA, a content platform exploring the ins and outs of human behaviour. He's also co-host and producer of the Why We Do What We Do podcast. His name is Ryan O'Donnell, but he also goes by Ryan O. He's a behaviour analyst by training, and in his words, he wakes up daily trying to fill the gap between the amazing science of behaviour and the billions of people that it could impact for the better. He's here to talk to us about bringing behaviour to a bigger world. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you very much. I'm super excited to be here. You know, you write those bios yourself sometimes and then you hear them and it's like totally different. It's like, that's interesting.
I know. I have that same experience when people read them out. I'm like, oh, wow, really? I do all that? Okay, cool. So just as a bit of backstory for our listeners, I discovered you, I think, through Instagram, and it was probably a hashtag and I don't really know, but I suddenly found this very cool content that was talking about human behavior from a slightly different angle to the way that I'm used to talking about it, but also with a kind of a dynamism, a kind of energy, music, you know, fantastic video, all of this stuff that I hadn't really seen much before in our world. And I was excited because I thought, I think, you know, whilst I don't do any of that flashy stuff, I think I'd found a like-minded soul in terms of bringing some of this behavior to a wider, or behavior analysis, psychology, human behavior, to a wider audience. So I was excited to have you here. And I'm keen to know, because this is not something I know much about, what is behavior analysis to start with?
So in the psychology world, it's really rooted in the beginnings of like B.F. Skinner's work. And there's kind of like two approaches to it. Sometimes I preface these sort of conversations with, if anybody's heard of Skinner and you've heard of things, there's kind of two worlds. There's the world that was kind of popularized, especially by himself and a lot of like early, really strong academic followers. And then there's this kind of different branch. It's kind of bred into and morphed, I would say, into something that's a little more modern, but also a little more appetizing and like appealing and collaborative with other branches out there. And so there's kind of these two worlds, the traditional and the more modern approach. I fell in love with both, really, to be honest. Behavior analysis, just as globally stated, usually is like the science of behavior. And the idea is that behavior is anything that we do. And as a result, anything potentially in the world that has to do with human behavior or animal behavior, et cetera, is a realm of possible study. And that's what I loved about it, was the idea of flexibility in potential career, job, project, whatever. Like, I found it very interesting. And that wide scope is what really interested me. But behavior analysis, if you like look into it modern day, is pretty, I would say primarily, meaning about 90% or so folks are primarily practicing in autism, helping with autism therapy and those sort of works. So there's kind of this also public face of what it's known for when you search around. But what I fell in love with myself and many others in our field is just this possibility of a science behavior, understanding why we do what we do, and being able to help solve problems. So that's usually my long form pitch, at least of behavior analysis and what it is.
Yeah. And I can kind of understand, I think I can relate to that idea, because I know, you know, certainly as a psychologist, a lot of people, when I say I'm a psychologist, they automatically imagine somebody who does clinical counseling, therapeutic, individual type work, which is something I've never actually done. So there's a sort of a perception of what the field does. And then there's all the really fascinating meaty stuff behind it.
Yeah.
That attracts and enthralls, hopefully, all of us, certainly some of us.
Yeah, that's what I got interested in, is really behavior analysis is a worldview. There's a lot of them out there. It's the one I subscribe to. I like it. I share it, obviously. But it's best like paired with others and really a collaborative sort of environment. The applications have been so cool from, you know, I mentioned a lot of works on autism and such, but there's organizational behavior management, a little small branch of folks that work in a similar capacity to what you were describing. And there's been a clinical behavior analysis, which is focusing on a little more of that clinical role. There's a therapy that was actually founded, developed slowly here in Reno, where I'm based, called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is modern third wave CBT approach. So there's these like inroads, I guess. And sometimes when people hear the older roots of Skinnerian and such, like it's advanced pretty far beyond that.
And can we talk for a moment just about that? Because you and I know exactly what we're talking about when we talk about Skinnerian approaches or theory. Let's share that a little with the audience. Who was Skinner? What did he do?
Yeah, man, I would say 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s was kind of his, lack of a better word, reign in psychology. Really dominant view of trying to look at how the environment influences behavior. And during that time, it was a change from introspection and looking inwards and trying to figure out what was going on from the approach of like Freud. And he was focusing much more on the opposite side of that spectrum on, you know, the environment influences behavior. And there's a lot of words like the environment controls your behavior and things like that that just they're not palatable, I would say, when it comes to thinking about the essence of being of the human experience and what we do and how we go about our day to day. And so it created a dominant view during that time period, is my understanding. And then a lot more of a wave came in on looking more at the cognitive aspects of what's going on. And it's kind of interesting now how that seems like they're in a little bit of a way, kind of meshing back together, looking at, you know, what's going on, presumably on the cognitive inside aspect as well as environmentally, and how they come together and really influence what we do day to day.
Yeah. When you think about it, when you look back over the history, you know, it was the beginning of really trying to understand learning and thinking, as you say, from an environmental, you know, mm-hmm. how do human beings learn? And it seems insane now when you think about it that we hadn't really had kind of terribly scientific or, you know, way of studying that until the 1920s or 30s or 40s or 50s, but we didn't, you know. So it was probably perhaps the beginning of turning some of this human behavior into more of a science and less of a philosophical pursuit, maybe.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the use of it. And certainly when I did some research in the field or just looking at, you know, what is behavior analysis, particularly in an Australian context, because that's where I'm based, almost everything I found related to behavior modification, particularly with autism. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
That branch, if we're kind of following the timeline, a lot of applied work, which is just really anyone trying to help somebody with a socially significant issue that they're experiencing in their life, started to really happen in the 60s, 70s, started to really grow. Behavior modification is what it was called at the time, still kind of is. The term, at least in our field, is kind of known as this time period where we were figuring out how to go from the lab to help people out. And so you literally had scientists think like straight up white coats in the lab trying to figure out how to work with humans and help them out.
Because often they were using, I know Skinner used pigeons and things, didn't he? You know, they were often using animal models in the lab to work out what human behavior might do.
Yeah, there was a ton of animal models. And so during that time, there was a lot of kind of confirmation, but also seeing where things broke down. One of the biggest areas was language. We realized that there was some similarities, basic principles of how rewards and punishments and things like that work. But across species. But when it came to language, that's one area where like it's totally different. And that's why acceptance commitment therapy and those things kind of have a different taste and feel now. But the autism work really started in what was traditionally at the time being diagnosed as mental retardation, working with people with various intellectual developmental disabilities. Now, granted, those terms aren't used anymore. The landscape, at least in the States here, are DSM and how we go about the diagnostics of these things has changed. And what kind of solidified us in working a lot in that area was there's kind of two developments, more and more research and progress on like how to help people that were experiencing learning difficulties with disorders, disabilities like that. And then there was a success story really that turned into a book called Let Me Hear Your Voice, A Family's Triumph Over Autism by Catherine Maurice, that I don't know the full story here, but kind of took the waves and was sold quite well and complimented. Like we had the science, but she kind of popularized it, I would say, in a way as indirectly, and I think accidentally. And that kind of put us on the map when it came to funding sources getting interested. It was the fact that we could help folks out, but also do that. So there's a little bit of controversy sometimes when it comes to how autism now is approached. So for example, it's fit in a medical model where diagnose, treat is kind of typically what it is. But in a sense, like that's a characteristic. There's characteristics and individualities that come with autism, and saying we're going to treat that seems like an attack in a way too, personally, for some people, rightfully so. And so we're rooted in this medical model And I would say kind of what's going on right now is really rapid growth in certification, trying to meet the demand that has essentially been established as a result of being successful in helping people in that area. And it causes a little bit of a turbulent time. For example, like the main certification in the field, I want to say it's over the last 3 years, over half of the folks that have entered the field have entered in that last 3 years.
Okay.
So exponential growth. Yeah, yeah. So it's very interesting time as to what's going on. But yeah, there's when it comes to evidence-based approaches to helping people with autism, there's a number of them out there, a number that are growing as well. The still top tier with the most evidence as to approaching those is what they call applied behavior analysis. And if anyone wants to learn more, I'd say the Association of Science and Autism Treatment, ASAT online, is probably a great place to go check it out to learn a little bit more about the backing as to why I'm making those claims and what other therapies are currently being investigated and researched.
Yeah. And we could have a whole other philosophical conversation about neurodiversity and, yes, those things you alluded to, that, you know, whether this is actually something that needs to be treated or whether it's more of a conceptualization for society of understanding all of the strengths and wonderful things that come with people who see the world in a different way. But we won't go down that path because I've got lots of other things I'd like to ask you. So we've talked then a bit about, you know, the history and what it is and some of the applications. What got you interested in it? Where did you kind of start?
The long story short is I took a Psych 101 class and it was the only class I enjoyed and did all right in my first semester. I went in thinking, you know, oh, pre-med, like I'll go into medical somehow, I'll make lots of money and blah, 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 blah. And then I came out of that first semester, I remember getting completely wrecked in like chemistry. I didn't know how to learn myself at that time. Like I didn't know how to apply myself and self-manage, a lot of little things that are needed. So I went and I was like just sitting down after a rough semester, really, for the first time in my life. And like, what do I want to do? And I was like, I'm just going to chase that psychology thing. So I signed up for a psychology 205 right after 101, like in the sequentially was the next one. Behavior analysis class was the first time that I didn't struggle necessarily. I was doing pretty well in, and I found myself interested. Here in Reno, Nevada, like we're home to a lot of really cool things that we can go do in the outdoors. Oftentimes I'd skip school if I could go skiing or snowboarding and things like that. It was the first class I had on a Monday morning where I didn't want to skip to go snowboard. And I was like, I should probably pursue this. Yeah.
That's telling you something.
Yeah, that got me through the door. And then I convinced my professor at the time to hook me up with a job essentially on and like a practicum placement to start learning how to apply what I was learning in there. And that really hooked me, like seeing measurable change. I think for anybody that's interested in psychology, especially helping others through providing some sort of form of therapy or whatnot, that was really liberating to me. And then to go back to the beginning of the conversation, that sense of job security of like, oh, everything's human behavior. I could kind of chase this but not be locked into something. Yeah, flexibility is a great way to describe it. So yeah, that's how I got into it.
Okay. But you're doing more than just that.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
You're doing lots of other cool stuff as well. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. So once I finished up undergrad, I got into a grad program. Essentially, to work in that certification system, it's called a board certified behavior analyst. It's our master's level credential. I was signed up for a master's degree program and went into there, knocked out my board certifications. And there's a lot of different roles you can take in the field, from case manager, where you're handling anywhere from 15, 25 cases, where you're helping people out in a variety of different situations, clinical directors, where you're overseeing programs and things like that. And for me, I kind of hopped around a bunch for 3, 4, 5 years, different roles. Actually got interested in a little bit of the, how do we make a great organizational culture and environment? I got a little bit more interested in those set of things. And I realized business, starting things up, figuring out the things that are a little more nuanced, unclear, that comes with like starting a program or starting services is what I was really interested in. So I chased opportunities like that down for a little bit, working in a few different places, either in nonprofit settings for adults with disabilities, helping start some different services for that population. I always talk about them as like they were fueled on behavior analysis, but that was about it. It was fueled there, but like you wouldn't see much of it. And then also figuring out just where other possibilities could go. So at one point, I started a business with a couple of colleagues, ended up air quote failing, learned a lot of lessons from it, but we were trying to help people in gifted and talented areas, which we were really good at, but it was the marketing and the sales and the business side that I realized mm-hmm. I was really poor at. And about during that time when that was a struggle for me and we were realizing, and also like founders' interest change, we decided that we were just like, that didn't work. It was fun. What's next? I was on YouTube and I was clicking through video after video of some guy that I didn't know, obviously, big YouTuber. His name's Casey Neistat, dominated YouTube for years and video blogs. And I was just like, why am I so consumed? Like, it kept me up all night. I'm like, why am I so consumed about this guy I've never met? I thought it was the most ridiculous thing to point a camera in your face and like record your life. And I'm sitting here like in a studio with a couple of cameras pointed at me and things like that. So it was like a fast day-to-day process of like trying to figure it out. But it's been a few years of realizing that it's very hard to craft a story in general, especially if you're trying to do science communication and bridge what is technically being said into something that's consumable. And then the technical aspects of audio, video, it was all just kind of whooping my butt. And it was the next kind of fun thing that I just couldn't stop chasing down. And to kind of connect the dots, I realized that the field that I was in, that I was loving, needed somebody that fit that role. And there was a potential to kind of fulfill that role. And the question was like, could I do it well enough to make it a job? So a couple of years ago, 2018 is where I was just like, I'm going to start throwing some stuff up on YouTube and see what happens. And it's been 2 years. I don't make money off of YouTube. It's not like YouTube is that lucrative, if anybody out there is wondering, but throwing a lot of free content out there leads me to some paid gigs, helping others in their business, essentially market, capture what they're doing, share it. So I got into a lot of media-based things, video, podcasts, and I would say live streaming sometimes are the kind of the main things that I do now day to day, but it's always for the consumers of people that are getting those services and working with those providers.
And I'm really interested in something that you said in there about the science communication thing, because I think this is something that I know it's something that I've always been interested in, but kind of struggled with as well. And I know that's probably the same for a lot of our peers in parallel fields. I'm thinking neuroscientists and academics and the scientists and even the clinicians to some extent are really good at knowing their stuff, understanding that science, like any fields, tend to speak their own language. There's a fair bit of jargon, you know, we can kind of forget that not everybody knows exactly what this term means or that term means or this acronym, whatever. And so making that jump from being able to translate the science to a conversation that can then be absorbed by, as you say, a consumer. So whether that's the end user of a service or even just our general population, you know, when we think about human behavior, we can all benefit from learning more about human behavior. Well, what's that been like for you trying to make that jump?
It's been super exhilarating and fun because every day I'm learning something new. There's a different process that I'm having to understand. It's a lot too. And that's not like in a way that it's stressful or whatnot, but there's just a lot of components that I didn't realize that were very important to it. So like when it comes to science communication, how you're talking about running across a hashtag at some point, I ran across SciComm, the hashtag SciComm for short for science communication, and found this world of scientists that were trying to communicate their science. And I was like, wow, this is the thing that I'm interested in. And at the same time, there's a behavior analyst that I was interviewing one time. And he's like, you know, it sounds like you're doing something that other people are doing. You should read this book. And so I was past a couple of different resources. And I was just like, oh, that's a thing I'm chasing, kind of like this combining of fun with modern media and what it can potentially do with the science that I love. So it's a lot every day. I've just taken it kind of day by day. And what can I learn when it comes to like camera basics? The best thing was just pick up a camera and start. But also after a while, you can only watch so many YouTube tutorials or like there's not enough there. So I took some formal classes later on online to just kind of clean up my skill sets. When it comes to SciComm and storytelling, which I think is a big part of that, I've been doing a lot of trying to read into what those are. So I was able to take a workshop with a gentleman named Randy Olson that wrote a really cool book called Houston, We Have a Narrative, which was a tenured professor, I want to say in microbiology, marine biology, I believe, and was like recounting on how Jurassic Park came out. Everyone was talking about it in the early 90s, and that he saw anecdotal increases, but like really noticeable in the number of people applying to like archaeology programs in their university, as well as going to the museum. And he's like, man, if I'm trying to get people interested in this stuff, like maybe I go do that film stuff. And so I was able to sit through a workshop with him, and it just seems like it's this area where people are trying to figure out how do we get people interested in things that are going to make the world a little bit better, potentially trying to figure out how to compete with media headlines, clickbait things, you know, like there's a lot of practices out there that are, I guess, don't jive as well with scientists. And so it's been this fun pursuit of trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Just as you were saying that was exactly what I was thinking, is that, you know, traditionally media, well, not traditionally, certainly current times, contemporary media, it's headlines. And from a scientific point of view, and it's an enormous frustration, I know, for probably, well, certainly for me, I don't know, for a lot of my colleagues, that what becomes the headline can so often be almost misrepresentative of what the actual issue is. There isn't an opportunity in a quick audio grab or in a headline or with a journalist, not necessarily with any scientific training and their interpretation of an issue, and just, you know, the human negativity bias. We want to hear the things that we think might be scary or threatening or alarming to us, even if that's not necessarily helpful and only a fraction of the story. So being able to bring some of that more nuanced conversation, is that part of your goal?
I would say each day is, how can I get people interested in things that aren't as interesting as those? Like, that's kind of what I'm trying to pursue.
Yeah, okay. Balance it out a bit.
Yeah, which I've just realized is comes down to really good audio, really good imagery, really good stories, really interesting characters, you know? And I've grown an appreciation for any movie or any great thing that I've watched, regardless of the medium in the past or consumed. I've just realized, like, whoa, it takes a lot more. And so, yeah, that's, I guess, the things I'm chasing. One of the bigger projects right now is actually trying to figure out how to apply a lot of those in like a formal, self-funded, partially funded by someone else, I guess, like independent documentary film, to see if we can at least capture. I feel like sometimes it's like I can do pretty well at capturing, you know, 1 or 2 minutes of people's attention sometimes online, but like, can I do it for an hour using some of these strategies? I don't know. But we're going to try it.
Did you ever imagine, when you think back to when you started perhaps your original degree, or you started in those more clinical elements of behavior analysis, that this is where you would be come some years down the track?
Definitely not. Yeah, definitely not. There was two things. There was probably 5 years into behavior analysis for me, so 2014, 15-ish sort of time period for me, there was two things, the discussion around a podcast, starting a podcast up, as well as the discussion around creating YouTube videos. And at the time, I thought both of them were ridiculous because I thought that they weren't relevant to like what scientists did, was my perspective, as well as they weren't things that we were necessarily equipped for. And I said, we, as like, there was a community of us that would talk about trying to create things there. And I was like, no, we got more to learn before we start doing that. You know, maybe that's somebody else's expertise. So yeah, 5 years ago, I was like, the complete opposite side of that spectrum. I was like, that's not a thing that we do. And now it's a thing I do day to day, all the time.
Do you have many kind of colleagues, peers? Have you come across many other people doing? I know if you do spend a bit of time on YouTube, you'll find people who do take the time, and sometimes it's in animated form and different applications, but trying to take a bit of everyday science and bring it to a bigger audience.
Yeah. One of the ones that really inspired us at the beginning when we were exploring these ideas, that small group, was Crash Course, which did Crash Course Psychology, Crash Course Biology, a bunch of different things out there. And so there's definitely different flavors and approaches out there. And for the most part, I was trying the last few years to just kind of figure out how, like, all the variables that go into creating something that comes down to a video. And now, after a couple of years of playing around with that, it's like, okay, I think I've figured out all the different things enough to where it's like, let me really focus on the strategy now as to like how I apply them all together. So I used to have this rule that every time I uploaded a video, I had to try at least one new like editing strategy or shooting strategy or something like that. So sometimes there's videos out there that may not be super useful, but it was like me testing something and kind of putting those together. So anyhow, now it's kind of like I'm relooking at those Crash Course Psychologies, what people are doing on YouTube, Facebook video, LinkedIn. And it's like, okay, like, how can I approach this in a smarter, more strategic fashion?
One of my great philosophies, and I know all my listeners have heard this before, in life is test and learn.
Yeah.
You know, and every time you're trying something, just test it and see if it works, it works. If it doesn't, you know, you're probably going to learn something. In fact, if it doesn't, you might learn more, and then take it from there, see what happens.
And there was another component that you reminded me of when you're bringing it up, which was in behavior analysis, podcasts, things like that, the academic community, there was a couple of folks that were playing around with these ideas, especially there's like four or five people, I'd say, primarily, or like groups that were trying to forge this forward. But in our field right now, it's very much like a new thing. So part of, I guess, what I've been trying to do also is, how do I capture some of the attention of the people that are in the field that essentially I need to be working with and collaborating with if I want to put great stuff out there? So part of the last couple of years of getting this started was, you know, how do you get some of the more influential, prestigious academics and such that are out there to pay attention and realize, like, hey, we could work together. I could bring my strengths. You could bring your 30 or 40 years of history and what you've learned, and we can try to push that a little bit farther. So that's also been, I guess, on the back end of what I've been trying to figure out too.
And do you get a receptive audience when it comes to doing those sorts of things? Are they on board with this idea, or is it all a bit too foreign?
Yeah, I would say that it was more foreign at the beginning. It's becoming less and less over time. But to start there, like, I was really surprised at how receptive people were literally like day one when I uploaded something. I remember looking at, you know, the views, and you're like, oh, there's 10 views on this video. There's 20, there's 40, there's 100, there's 200. It's just like, I didn't know that for YouTube is extremely small. But like when it was, you know, 2 years ago on the first video upload, I was like, hey, like, this is a lot of eyeballs. And so it's one of those things where I think, like with most things, like, you're demonstrating over time, like with your behavior and the things that you do, that you're reputable, you care, trying to do it for the right reasons, things like that. I think that's compounding over time and making it easier and easier. Whereas in the beginning, it was, you know, who's the guy with the hat making YouTube videos about behavior analysis?
Yeah. And that's what I suppose one of the interesting things about this is a field. Maybe it exists in every field, but what you're doing really is building relationships there. So you're building mm-hmm. relationships with an audience. Mm-hmm. And as they get to know you, get to know who you are, what you do, your credibility, your style, you know, your vibe attracts your tribe thing. And that is about just putting the content out there, isn't it? And seeing what works.
Yeah, I realized pretty early that I ran out of stuff to say if I wasn't learning enough. And eventually, if I was ambitious and uploading a lot, like, I'd run out of stuff to say really quickly. Like, I couldn't read fast enough to learn enough to communicate out there. So I realized that I had to network and start to figure out how to make it not about what I'm interested in necessarily, but what this group of people are interested in. So that's where I started exploring a lot with different interviews and different approaches to kind of creating stuff.
And are there particular topics that you found seem to capture your audience attention more readily than others?
So anything that is a little more controversial and things like that, that kind of follow those headlines and things that we talked about, will definitely increase the number of people who click through and pay attention to things. If that's, for example, some sort of drama in the field or something new that's potentially coming out and whatnot, those things always seem to do pretty well. But I've slowly learned that there's certain types of consumers are on certain types of platforms, which makes sense. But it was something where you start to learn, like, oh, this idea will perform really well, say, on Instagram versus something on YouTube, or just based on where the audience is. So I've learned quite a bit about who on the back end is watching and consuming these sort of things, and how to start to create more specific content to them, as well as there's certain keywords that are clearly more important. So I was saying how fast and how quickly our field's growing over here, especially in the States with that certification system, is anything that's around people that are in the early stages of their career. There's generally much more of a population that is a younger crowd that's more on these social platforms in certain ways looking for those sort of things. So it was one of those things that I've learned more about what keywords, where the attention is, what's great for which platforms.
And I suppose that brings me to my next question, which is really where to from here. If you've got that audience, perhaps of younger people who are starting in the field mm-hmm. and consuming your content, and they're excited about the stuff you've got to tell them, where do you think you might take it for you, but also for the field, I think?
So I realized through a few different people that I've looked up to in the field calling on me that I can help them, in a sense, kind of scale some of what they're doing. So one thing that's come out of this is that I always thought on the back end, like, maybe I could help people out, but it's clear that this is working better and better. It's just working with folks that are in therapy, training roles, academic roles, workshop roles, and like, how can we capture some of what they have to say so they don't have to say it repeatedly? And how do we leverage technology, right, to where they can focus on what they need to be focused on? So there's a couple of things I'm helping with that are specific to the autism therapy world, where we're trying to essentially kind of automate through video people getting certain types of information so that the clinicians can work in during training, I guess, and workshops. So where top people in our field can get it to more people more quickly and efficiently so that they can spend more time on the intricacies and the showing them as opposed to some of the telling them and things. So that's been part of it. The other part was like I wanted a more ambitious project. So that's where I found a partner last year that was willing to, I say this jokingly kind of, but partially serious, like kind of blindly support me on half of this adventure on a documentary piece, which was really fun. And I think that would be something I'd continue like to chase. I like big challenges that take me months or a potential, you know, year or so to kind of build and work towards. And it's one of those things that I think about sometimes on when it comes to setting goals and what you want to do and where you want to go. It's a little weird to set goals based on other people's behavior, especially that you don't know. Like when you start to define your own self-worth, goals, values based on other people, like that could be really tricky and a really slippery slope very quickly. But in a sense, there's these people that I watch online. There's these online creators that I don't live or die by this, but it's like, can I create things that they'd be interested in? Like in a sense, the people that I look up to, can I create as well as they do with the stories that I'm interested in and get their attention? And it's kind of a test, right? I don't need their approval, but it's like, can I do it as well as they're doing? You know, and that's something that I'm kind of pursuing on the back end too.
Part of learning, you know, the role modeling part of learning, isn't it? You know, if they're role modeling something that inspires and excites you, then, you know, the challenge then is to see if you can not replicate the behavior, but
grow
yourself in that direction to see what you learn from it.
Yeah. So I've got, like with this documentary project I'm working on, I've made a couple of connections with people in YouTube that are running channels of more around the 250,000 sort of range that luckily I made those connections over the last couple of years slowly. And they were like, send me the trailer. And I was like, hey, cool. Like it took 3 years, found a couple of people. We'll see if they click through and enjoy it. So it's been one of those things I've been pursuing that as well. At some point, I think I may want to pause and see if I can start to create specifically things that are for people that are consuming these sort of things that are helpful, not necessarily therapy tips and such, but just like some general information on here's what psychology is, here's what we're talking about, some instructional sort of content. So I do have this back end goal of maybe in the next year, two, three, see if I can create things specifically that people can click into that are on mental health, behavioral health, that may be struggling. And so I'm experimenting with that now through highlighting different services, things that are being provided and such. So ambitious, I guess, but that's kind of like
going on. And I love you are obviously always thinking a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years ahead rather than being so bogged down in obviously what must be a lot of work in the moment as well.
Yeah. I was talking with a colleague before we hopped on here and we're meeting up at a conference next week. And I was like, you know, I spend like 99% of my days mostly in this room by myself, editing, creating, that's it. And so just going to a conference next week, I was like, I'm ready for some social interaction because what I share is usually really cool stuff and it's really awesome highlights, but they are just a super small sliver of like the reality of content creation. I'm sure you know that too.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a constant kind of treadmill, but well, nice to be able to have that balance as well, to be able to go and actually connect with real people face-to-face for a while in the midst of doing the other bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Just I wanted to pick up on that you were just talking about there in terms of where this could go. And I suppose I'm interested in your take, you know, not just for you, but for the fields perhaps around therapy, around human behavior, around mental health, because it is pretty new to be able to be taking this content out, whether it's on a podcast, whether it's on YouTube, whether it's through any kind of online or digital platform and creation around that. Where do you think, I've had a couple of conversations recently with, you know, what does the future of mental health, again, you know, inverted commas, look like? What's your take on that? Where could this take us?
A few things come to mind. Like it's clearly a huge topic, I think worldwide from my understanding. I'm obviously, you know, in the US bubble more so, but it's a huge topic. There's a lot of questions around prevalence rates, best strategies. Are we just finding it better? Are they really increasing? Like, I don't know how to rank these things, but it seems like one of the top five, at least, issues that we're facing and across borders. And so when I look on specifically YouTube and Instagram and some of these social cultures, it seems like it's a lot of things that people are struggling with, a lot of people that are talking about. And I think the potential that we're in now is anyone interested in psychology is now is the time to start to figure out how to use those platforms and how to use those people that are work with those people that are very interested in this to try to share some of what we know actually does work. And so that's where I could see anybody potentially working, regardless of like what area of psychology you're in or what you're interested in. It's like if you start to figure out and have expertise in what works, maybe we can start getting that through these sort of platforms to folks. So yeah, like mental health, crazy important. I know there's some preventative strategies and things like that that I just kind of seem to have luckily found early in my life. And there was a lot of situations that I was also afforded with my parent, family, social sort of settings and whatnot. But there's clearly research out there and like these sort of things just kind of stack the deck in the favor of people being in a better position to handle any sort of issues that life throws at them. And I think one thing that I'm trying to figure out with this realm of what I'm going down, but will require folks like you and I or others collaborating, figuring this out, is how do we create things for those platforms that help those people? Mm-hmm. And so I think a big opportunity is like figuring out how to share exciting, engaging content that is useful, entertaining, that potentially could be in that preventative realm. So for example, things that I think about nowadays, like how could you take something like TikTok that is all over the world and has people, I don't know, generally 7 to 18 that are probably generally on that platform, how could you create something that's interesting that taught them just a basic little strategy about self-care, about laughter, the importance of social interaction, you know, how to put your phone down, like whatever it is. Like, I think there's opportunities to try to figure out how to use those platforms for good. I just don't know what that is and how to do that necessarily. And that's what I've been chasing. So I don't know, rabbit holes potentially, but things that come up when I think about that.
I absolutely agree. I think we need to meet people where they are. And if we're talking about, and I have kids in that age group, and so I know how they use the digital platforms. I was saying to somebody the other day, we were talking about TVs and where, you know, I grew up watching TV as it was, you know, in Australia, we didn't even have cable of any description when I was young. So it was free to air TV. That was it. You know, my children don't turn a TV on. They wouldn't even know how to work their way TV really, because they're on YouTube where they can almost entirely create their own content.
Yeah.
And they are on, well, not both of them, but the old one, the 11-year-old, is on TikTok and he's on Instagram and that is their world. And I think, yeah, you're right. It's to me, and I'm maybe just thinking this through as I'm saying it,
yeah,
but how do we actually meet them where they're at? So understanding what it is that engages them in their world and then incorporate some of this.
Yeah.
And again, I'm very much of the preventative mindset. You know, I've got wonderful colleagues who spend time doing the fix it when it's gone wrong part, mm-hmm, but I'm very much, you know, about those sorts of strategies. What do we do in pos-psych? What do we do in preventative mental health? What do we know just about the really simple things like getting out and exercising and you know,
yeah,
social interaction and getting good sleep.
Yeah. And I think that's where it's, how do you take those concepts, but the virality of like a cat video on YouTube? How do you bridge those gaps? And that's kind of what I've been thinking about and trying to chase down.
Yeah, fascinating. So interesting. I can see lots of possibilities in that. And I think it's so cool that you are learning as you go.
Yeah.
I think that's a great opportunity. I think it's B, something that so many more people in probably all the scientific realms, even if just to counter, and I suppose that was going to be another question I was going to ask, but, you know, trying to counter some of the perhaps less reliable stuff that's out there. You know, if you are going to guide someone or advise someone, you know, how do you find good content given that YouTube is out there for free, it's unregulated? How does somebody discern between what is going to be good, reliable, evidence-based content and what is not?
Yeah, you know, this would be a really good exercise and a really good YouTube video too, if I could figure this out. So I'm going to talk through ideas, but these are live thoughts. So I don't know, like some things that I think about is, in a sense, and I feel like some social platforms have started to do this, but like when you see something that's out there, is it reliable? It's like a question I always try to ask. I think one general strategy that seems to be pretty good is, and I even see this all the time in media, people are like, check out different sources, right? Like same topic, different sources. So oftentimes when we're prepping for like the Why We Do What We Do podcast, it's usually topics that I'm not an expert in, or I've got a little bit of experience and whatnot and interest in. And so it's like looking at, what are the TEDx speakers saying? Was there a TED talk on the main stage? What is the, some of the empirical potential, you know, science-based literature saying? What does websites like Psychology Today say, and the people that are writing in those areas? It's just kind of like a breadth of things, I feel like you can start to see patterns emerge when you're reading those. And for me, I start to do that even on YouTube content. I see so-and-so is talking about something, so-and-so is talking about something, you know, and they're all related. And I try to see what's going on there. So for me, it's trying to identify the patterns that are out there. For me, that's always also rooted in the way that I see the world operate and work. And so if there's things that have to do with, hope I don't divide any sort of listeners on this one, but if there's anything that has to do with potentially how like something like astrology may influence our psychology or things like that. For me, that's not something that I'm interested in believe in. I don't knock it. I'm not out there making stuff against it. But for me, it's, I guess I try to recognize where my biases are when I'm approaching these sort of things and what am I consuming and just try to check those sometimes. So part of that is seeing what other people that are close to my worldview, but different experiences, seem to think about the things that I may find interesting. So I feel like that social component, it's almost like a peer review process a little bit, right? Where you're like, hey, I found this thing. It looks pretty cool. What do you think? I still have some conversations about those. And I think that's useful. I find myself doing that on YouTube a lot, where a few different people that I know consume a lot of on that platform, I'll send them something and say, hey, check this person out. What do you think? And we kind of chit-chat back and forth. But I don't know. It's kind of like, got to continually be skeptical and check sources, realize where your biases are. That's something that like I find myself almost worried about. Like, am I stuck in my roots to the point where I kind of wake up one day and it's like, oh, it's been 5 years where I haven't like checked my biases, you know? I potentially haven't grown, or I've just been stuck in this with blinders on or something. So those are things that I think of, but in no way is that a full analysis of how to approach it.
I guess at the core of that, it's critical thinking, really, isn't it? You know, how do I think critically about all of the information I'm presented with? And I like that kind of using the people around you to check in on, am I getting this right? Is this the right take? Or what do you think? And going back to the points we were making before about, particularly if we're looking at preventative stuff, perhaps for younger kids, you know, kids using TikTok, you know, how do you incorporate maybe even a bit of learning around critical thinking?
Yeah.
I know I have colleagues here in Australia who are doing that, particularly with kids and online content, you know, helping them to understand that you've got this massive amount of information that's never been available to any previous generation before, but with great power comes great responsibility. You've got to be able to understand how to use that so that you are not being either led astray or, you know, I suppose for kids, you know, heading into danger zones or to our mental health and our physical health, listening to people for whom there isn't a whole lot of actual evidence for what they're telling us.
No, for sure. Yeah. It's things you have to learn about on like topics like metaphors, comedy, different types of comedic relief, like all of those things I think are potential advantages and things we could leverage, but also things that could be misunderstood and taken the wrong way. And that's part of, I think that large content creators and people out there doing a lot of stuff on social media right now realize the power of those sort of things. But I question how much they realize that maybe there's some folks out there they could partner with, like in different branches of psychology, they could show them, hey, you could achieve that, get your same laughter and rate of what you're looking for, but put it out there in a way that it's not potentially putting the wrong picture out there or harming anybody, you know, like,
or maybe doing good in the world.
Yeah.
You know, there's some meaning and purpose stuff in there as well. You know, could you do what you do in the way that you do it because you entertain and you engage an audience?
Yeah.
And could you also be helping people to live a better life somehow without it feeling like you're teaching them stuff?
I guess it's a lot of the people that I've resonated with on YouTube myself as a consumer was folks that, regardless of what they were doing, if sometimes you didn't love exactly the way that they pitched or described what they were doing, there was always this consistent of trying to make the world a little bit better, teaching a skill, modeling things, a little bit of escapism and entertainment. And I think since the attention's there, that's things that we should be paying attention to how they're affecting folks and maybe creating content for.
Yeah. And maybe that's the magic formula, isn't it? Just trying to find that, you know, how do we entertain, engage, teach, help to bring good upon the world. All in a YouTube video.
Right.
Ryan, thank you so much for all of that. That's been fascinating. And it is nice to meet someone else. Although, you know, when our listeners, I'll put all the links to all of your, you know, podcasts and the Daily BA and your Instagram, all of that,
cool,
so that they can see it for themselves, because it's a very visual, you know, you are operating in a far more visual well, I'm not operating in visual medium at all right now. So, you know, it's a whole different scale and scope. And I admire your, because I'm still always reluctant to even put myself on video, let alone master the intricacies of it, because it is a whole new set of skills, a whole new area of learning. Yeah. So they'll be able to see all of that.
When you're asking about, did you ever see yourself doing this? This was not a thing that, like, I didn't put my life on social media in that sort of sense. And I wasn't the extrovert, like, growing up and in high school, but, like, things change, shifts. You know, like,
that's interesting, isn't it?
For me, yeah, you get a taste of it and you realize some of the benefits of it. Not that it's all benefits, but yeah, I love connecting with people. If anyone clicks through, have questions, comments, critiques, like, that's how I get better. So I always encourage folks to reach out and provide this sort of feedback. Around this time, there's a pretty cool, that film that we're working on is coming out about the time of the release of this podcast. The trailer is, sorry.
Yeah.
So if people want kind of an idea of what I've been talking about, that'll be up.
Fantastic.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Look, as I said, you know, it's great to meet a like-minded soul of doing it slightly differently. You've got some fantastic, big, ambitious goals and plans. And I really do think that not only is that bringing behavior to a bigger world, but I think I can really see some meaning and purpose stuff in there that fuels and motivates us to be able to serve a bigger world, serve the people in it. So congratulations on all of that.
Thank you. That's the goal.
I'll pop all the links so that everyone can find all of your work, some of the resources that we've mentioned over the course of our discussion. And I'll encourage all our listeners to, go and check out the Daily BA and the Why We Do What We Do podcast and the trailer and everything else. We'll keep tabs on it. I'll keep everyone up to date.
Cool.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so now you've heard him, you'd better go watch him. I've put links to Ryan's YouTube channel, his social media channels, his articles on Medium, his podcast, he really is everywhere, in the show notes for this episode. And I've also added some of the resources that he mentioned during our conversation, including a link to a book that he didn't mention, but it's by Randy Olson. And you might remember that Ryan said that he attended a workshop on science communication with Randy Olson. So I was intrigued and looked him up, and Randy Olson has a book available called Houston, We Have a Narrative. And it's written for scientists and those interested in communicating scientific concepts to help them transform the way science is understood and appreciated. So he's basically explaining how to use what Hollywood knows about storytelling and applying it to scientific knowledge to make it more engaging and more attractive and therefore get the knowledge out there. So I bought Houston, We Have a Narrative on audiobook, and I've started listening to it and I am really enjoying it so far. So if you're a scientist and you'd like to know how to incorporate storytelling into your work to get your message across, you might like to look it up. So the link is also in there in the show notes at potential.com.au/podcast. Now, don't forget my free webinar on personality, what it is, what we can change, and what role it plays in our motivation. It's on Monday, the 16th of March at 10 a.m. Australian Daylight Savings Time. The link to register is also in the show notes. And of course, if you register but can't attend, because maybe you're on the other side of the world to Australia and that makes the time we go live kind of stupid o'clock in your part of the world, I will send you a link to the recording after we've gone live. And perhaps if you have a question, but you can't attend live, send that through to me in advance and I'll answer it for you on the webinar. So you can email me at Ellen Jackson, that's one word, Ellen Jackson, at potential.com.au. I'm very excited also, not only about the webinar, but also to be bringing you next week's episode. I do get excited about every episode, if you can't tell. But next week, we have Dr. Susie Green back on the show. And Susie was one of our very first guests on the Potential Psychology podcast. She's also a colleague of mine and was my lecturer when I was doing my master's degree at the University of Sydney. And way back when she was on the show the first time around, when we launched almost 2 years ago, we talked about positive psychology and what it is and how it helps, as that is Susie's area of global expertise.
But next week, she's back to elaborate not only on that, but also to talk about her new book, which is called The Positivity Prescription, a 6-week wellbeing program based on the science of positive psychology. And here's Susie to tell you a little bit more.
We use this letter from the future, which is a fantastic coaching technique, which I refer to in the book. So in that, it's not talking about the specifics of where you're living, who you're married to. It's meant to be a fuzzy vision, and it's meant to have your values woven through it. So it's something like, you know, I wake in the morning, I'm in a relationship where I feel loved and I can share love. I get up and I do work that's really meaningful. And so it's meant to be fuzzy. And then at the beginning of every year, I set goals, I review my values, I review my letter from the future, and then I set goals for each of the areas of my life. So I walk and talk this stuff as best as I can, Ellen.
So I'm really looking forward to sharing that conversation with you, because I know that Susie will not only be sharing the science, but some really personal examples of how she puts that science to work in her life, which she absolutely does with verve and gusto. So that's next week, episode 76 of the Potential Psychology Podcast. Until then, have a fantastic week and go forth, thrive, flourish, and fulfill your potential.